Well, here we are again at the gate of a new year. I want to share a little quote that I got learned from my wife. She put it on her blog, and it's been one of my favorite ones around the new year. It came from a little book by a woman named Minnie Haskins, and she was quoted by King George VI of England in his radio broadcast in 1939. So he took a little portion of that. And this, you know, of course, 1939, Europe was heading into this war where things were really uncertain and really bad uncertain. And so he read this. She said, "I said to the man who stood at the gate of the year, 'Give me a light that I may tread safely into the unknown.' And he replied, 'Go out into the darkness and put your hand into the hand of God. That shall be to you better than light and safer than a known way.'" And I think that statement is so rich, because so much of what we head into in a new year is unknown. By definition, we haven't experienced it yet. And how much of what you experienced this past year would you have liked to have known ahead of time, before it hits you, like the train coming through the tunnel? Probably not very much. It's a blessing that we are not omniscient. And yet, it's very important that we put our hands into the hand of God as we head into a new year. You know, I think, not just in the church, but just in life in general, we try to start a new year on a positive note. You know, you have the image of the old year is like the old man. The image of the new year is like the new little baby. Everything's fresh. You know, get to start with a clean slate. It's really nice and positive. So, so much for that, because we're reading from a book that is an entire book of complaints to start off the new year. That's really positive, isn't it? Now, you know, I'm going to qualify that. Lamentations comes on the heels of Jeremiah's prophecy, and a lot of people think he wrote the book. I was sort of assuming that he wrote the book, but we actually don't know that for sure, for 100% sure, so we don't want to assume. But whoever wrote Lamentations, very possible it was Jeremiah. He lived in or near Jerusalem. Whoever wrote it was very close to Jerusalem when the Babylonians destroyed it in 587 BC. And he wrote the book almost immediately after all of that happened. And so the whole book is taken up with laments. They're not complaints the way we think of complaints, like whining. They're sanctified complaints. They're mourning, cries to God to have mercy. That's really what a lament is. And in fact, the Psalms, you've probably heard me say this more than you care to, the Psalms contain more laments than they do praise. So, the name of the book, Lamentations, comes from the first word in the Hebrew, which is alas. That's how it starts. So it ends with somebody crying out to God. I mean, it starts with somebody crying out to God, and it ends with somebody crying out to God. But I chose one of the few bright spots in the book that actually is positive. So you're welcome. but it's not just because it's a positive passage. This passage is really at the center of the book. And it's the center of the book, you know, from start to finish, and it's the center of the book in terms of the theme of the book, really what it means. And what it shows us is that our hope is based in God's faithfulness, not in our faithfulness, because, you know, that's what we tend to rely on. You know, you read everybody's New Year's resolutions, you know, you'd think that we were Superman, that, you know, that we're going to actually try to do all of these things, and it's not a bad thing to try. But our hope does not rest in our ability to keep our resolutions or to do anything. Our hope rests in God's faithfulness. And so I want to show you three elements of this passage. There's an outline there in your bulletin if you want to follow along. The first gives us an honest view of hardship, which we need. The second shows us what our hope is rooted in. And then the third tells us, how do we live? How do we live as we wait for God to restore everything that he says he's going to restore? So first I wanted you to see the difficulty demands brutal honesty. Now the first verses, they do sound pretty hopeless. "My endurance has perished, so has my hope from the Lord. Remember my affliction and my wanderings, the wormwood and the gall." You wondered why we sang that verse in "All Hail the Power of Jesus' Name," didn't you? That's why. "My soul continually remembers it and is bowed down within me." Now, what you've got to remember is context. What's going on with what this person is writing? This the author, whoever it is, has just watched the city of Jerusalem get wiped out. I mean, leveled to the ground. The glorious Temple of Solomon just absolutely destroyed. The walls of Jerusalem. And all of this, and this is not just any city in America, you know, getting destroyed. This was the identity of the people of Israel. This was their, you know, this was everything to them. And they really, really believed that it would never happen. God would never allow his city to be destroyed. And there it is. And so that's, it's a, there's a raw emotion about Lamentations. It's, you know, not only is the temple destroyed, the wall broken down, you know, the army's gone, the royalty has been deported. Almost everybody's been deported except for the poorest people. You know, women have been attacked and children have been killed with adults. It's just every, you know, the worst that you could imagine. And when I was trying to think of a modern comparison, the only one really that came to mind was the city of Berlin in Germany after the Third Reich fell, you know, when Hitler had committed suicide and you know, the country was in disarray. Berlin was just bombed to pieces. And the Soviets and the Americans had met at the Rhine River. And that it started a very uncertain time. And so the people that still lived in Berlin were really in terrible circumstances. Most of their homes were gone. They were just, you know, looking for any place that provided shelter. They're at the mercy of the elements. They have no food. The Soviet soldiers were just notorious, you know, for raping and killing people. It was just unbelievably desperate conditions. And then you go from that to the Soviet blockade, which leads into the Berlin airlift. It was just a terrible, terrible time. You know, that's what the most I can think of as far as a modern comparison to what Jerusalem's going through. But we need to understand that the man who wrote this, he's not saying that his hope in God has perished, but he's saying his hope of ever getting out of this situation has perished. Now, if this is Jeremiah, this is one of the reasons it fits to be Jeremiah, he knew that the exile was limited to 70 years because Jeremiah was the one that had prophesied that. God had told him, okay, you're going to go, Israel's going to go into exile for 70 years. But that still meant his entire generation was going to die in a foreign land, in a pagan country. And for a Jew, that's the second worst thing. You know, the worst thing is seeing your city destroyed and the temple destroyed. The second worst thing is you've got to spend the rest of your life in a pagan nation, away from the homeland. And so he uses the word wanderings, and it probably was literal. These are the people that are wandering around the city of Jerusalem, you know, just almost in a daze, trying to find food, trying to find people that, you know, relatives that were lost, they couldn't find in the destruction. So this phrase, the wormwood and the gall, is very important. The two words that are used there are used for two bitter herbs. And I'm sorry I'm going to use the Latin, not because I know Latin, but just because it's the only word that I could find that describes them. Artemisia absinthium. Absinthium is the word that we use, I think, commonly for one of them. And conium maculatum. I don't know what the word is for the second one. But the first, wormwood or absinthium, was used at one time to make hops and beer in England. It's just a very bitter herb, but you use it in very small amounts, and it can serve a purpose. The second one, gall, was used, many scholars think, as a sedative, may have been the source of the poison hemlock. But here, the writer of Lamentations is using this as a word picture. What he's saying is, okay, remember the bitterness. And what he's saying is he's talking about the way that they live, their idolatry. The idolatry of Israel, worshiping all these other gods, it was like a poison. And they took it willingly. And they, because they were trying to anesthetize themselves to difficulty by saying, okay, this God's going to provide. He promises to provide fertility. This one promises to provide good crops. This one promises to do this and this and this. So I'm going to sort of hedge my bets that maybe God can't handle all that. And this is what they did. And they were poisoning themselves. But they were doing it willingly. It was poisoning their souls. And God unleashed the judgment on Jerusalem as a severe mercy to wake them up to what they were doing to themselves. So this man is brutally honest about his suffering. He's convinced God has abandoned his people. But in reality, it's the opposite. God cared enough for these people to shock them into seeing their need of him. And the New Testament really shows us more how, especially this phrase, the wormwood and the gall is fulfilled. Matthew 27 ties it together when Jesus is suffering on the cross. He's offered gall twice. Earlier in his suffering, remember he's on the cross for several hours. Earlier in his suffering, they offer it to him and he refuses. Well, why would he refuse it? Remember, this is a sedative. He doesn't want to dull the sensation of his suffering. He wants to suffer for his people. He refuses it. Later, just before he announces that he's given up the ghost, he does accept a drink of wine mixed with gall, because at that point it's not going to have any effect on him. But what we see in Matthew 27 is that figuratively and literally, Jesus endured the gall of suffering for us. He suffered. And this is what we see in the incarnation. Not only did he come to be born as a baby, he came to live the life that we lived. He came to endure the temptations that we endure. And he came to suffer what we suffer for us. One of my favorite Christmas carols is Christina Rossetti's In the Bleak Midwinter. And I don't know if you saw on the Facebook page, I posted a little link to an article about it. And it's one of the most beautiful choral settings, for those of you that care about that. especially the Harold Dark tune, okay? Again, for those of you that care. But the words are just very, very powerful. But the interesting thing about it is it's not historically accurate. Jesus was not born in winter. He was born in spring. It was not bleak and cold. There was no snow on the ground as far as we know. But it's not the literal aspect or the historical aspect. It's the picture that she's painting. And one of the things I learned from this article was her brother said that Christina Rossetti in her life had what he called a spirit of self-postponement. And so she paints this image in this hymn to help us understand how God condescended to become a human being. He could have had, what is the phrase that she uses? When he returns, she says, heaven and earth will flee away when he comes to reign. And yet, it was a stable place that sufficed for him. Even though he could have had the world at his feet, he chose to be born into poverty. Abject poverty. And what her brother was saying was that Christina Rossetti embodied that same spirit in the way that she lived, as well as the way that she wrote. She was offered to be married twice by two different men. She declined them both because of doctrinal scruples, and she remained single her entire life. She struggled, fought illness her entire life, and yet she gave herself away for other people. She ministered to former prostitutes. She wrote poetry. She served her family. She served the church. She served the Lord rather than seeking her own comfort throughout her life. And one thing that she told her brother in 1888 was, I yet am well content in my shady crevice, which crevice enjoys the unique advantage of being to my certain knowledge the place assigned me. In other words, I realize my life is not easy, but I've chosen this. And this is the place that God has chosen for me, even through my choices. You see, when we respond to our circumstances, when they're not easy, it demands a delicate balance. We're called to be honest about our struggles. The writer of Lamentations is honest. But we're not called to wallow in our struggles. You know, I mean, you understand this balance, right? When you're, you know, somebody says, how are you doing? On the one hand, you could say, fine, which is what most of us do. When you're not fine. On the other hand, you could say, man, let me tell you, you got an hour. and you could just lay on them every detail of every problem that you're dealing with. Well, neither one of those extremes is good. We are called to be honest, but we are not called to wallow in our struggles and our sufferings. We should cry out to God in prayer, honestly, about what burdens us. We've got to be honest with each other, but we're also called to do what? To lift each other's burdens. You know, so there's got to be a back and forth. And so this really requires a mindset we don't always cultivate, even among Christians, and that's interdependence. And actually, if you look back on our values on the bulletin board at the back, that's one of our values, interdependence. So don't bear alone what you can share with others. On the flip side, don't get others to bear what you, I'm sorry, don't leave others to carry what you yourself can share. We're called to interdependence. All right, second thing I want you to see here, not only does difficulty demand brutal honesty, but hope rests in steadfast love. Look at verse 21. there's sort of a turn here. He says, but this I call to mind, and therefore I have hope. The steadfast love of the Lord never ceases. His mercies never come to an end. They're new every morning. Great is your faithfulness. And of course, this is where we get the hymn, Great is Your Faithfulness, which we'll sing in a little bit. There is something that overcomes the sadness of his circumstances. There's something that gives him hope. And this is where he says, the loving kindness, the steadfast love, the chesed, the covenant loyalty of God, the kind of love that never stops pursuing, never ceases. You see, what he tells us here is that God never stops working through our painful circumstances. He never stops changing us. He never stops working for our ultimate good. God doesn't ever sit back and say, oh, it's too bad. I wish I could do something. You know, and we do that in a lot of circumstances, and many times we can't. God never says that. But here's the problem. And I think this is true for Christians as well as non-Christians. The only conception that we have of God working in our circumstances is what? To stop the pain. That's the only category that we have. God, if you're working, then you'll stop it. If you love me, you'll stop it. But that's not the only category through which he works. Because many times he loves us too much to do that. He wants us to run to him. John Calvin said, he who is conscious of his own infirmity and directs his prayer to God will at length find a ground of hope. Now, if God's mercy never ceases, how's the next part true? How is it new every morning? Well, the author is looking at it from our perspective. We see God's mercy in new ways every morning, you know, like that cloud that I was driving by. And I've seen, you know, similar clouds plenty of times. But it just seems new. It's amazing every time we see it. You know, we see his beauty in creation. We see his love in people that love us, people that sacrifice to care for us. We see in our own pain how we need God. We see in his word how his love and the gospel is really all we need. God's mercies often surprise us because they come from places we don't expect. When I was poking around on the internet looking for information about Christina Rossetti's poem, In the Bleak Midwinter, I found a video of Susan Boyle singing it with the London Symphony Orchestra. And there was a boy choir behind. It's just gorgeous. And so then I saw off to the side on YouTube, you know, you have all these other options, other videos you can look at. They had a video of her first audition on Britain's Got Talent several years ago. And I hadn't seen that for a long time. And so I watched it again. And I just I love that story because it's so informative about human nature. You know, they're on this show and they've got this beautiful set and they have thousands of people and they have these these judges, Simon Cowell and some woman whose name I can't remember, and some guy named Piers. And they're having people come on. So this frumpy, gray-haired 48-year-old woman walks out on the stage, and Simon Cowell just, you know, kind of raises his eyebrow, like, what is she doing here? And how can I make fun of her? That's his first two thoughts in that order. And so, you know, they ask her, well, what do you want to happen? She says, well, I want to be a professional singer. And everybody laughs at her. Everybody, the whole crowd, they just laugh right in her face. I mean, think about how offensive that is and how hurtful that would be. And so you have Simon Cowell and these other two judges sitting there, and they have everything that the world has to offer. They have beauty, they have talent, they have wealth, they have fame. And then here's this woman. And the reason that the people laugh at her is that she doesn't have what the world has set as a standard for female singers, right? She doesn't look like a supermodel. She doesn't have the shape. She doesn't have the face. She doesn't have the dress. And so she cannot, by definition, be a professional female singer. But what I love about that video is watching everyone's expressions when she opens her mouth and begins to sing. And it just, everybody's expressions are transformed. And to the crowd's credit, immediately, they begin cheering. And it's wonderful. It makes you cry every time. Because they recognize beauty, even though 5 seconds before, they had scorned her. She wins them over by the power of the beauty in her voice. And she instructs them She corrects their understanding. She does have what it takes to be a professional singer, not because of her looks or because of her dress, but because of the gift that God has given to her. That's what I love about that story. And one of the judges, the woman whose name I can't remember, said she essentially, without using so many words, she said, "I'm sorry. We were very disrespectful to you." She didn't use those words, but she said "It has been a privilege to hear you sing today." And I think she recognized that this woman deserves dignity, and they had not offered it to her. It's very powerful. But God's love surprises us in ways that are similar to that, you know, that whole story of Susan Boyle. He showers it on all kinds of people that we don't expect. God didn't pursue you because you were the most talented or the most beautiful or the most successful or the most wealthy or the most whatever. God pursued you because he loves you. And he loves you more than you can ever fathom, more than you could ever understand. We don't even have a category for his love for us. And he can't stop loving you. No matter what you do, he can't and he won't stop. In the same way, we need to be just as indiscriminate. I realize we're not God, but we need to be indiscriminate in the ways that we share God's love. We have received it that way. We need to share it that way. Our hope is in God's love to us, and we need to share that hope in the same way, with rich, with poor, with every race, with every nation and people, with young and old, with every person that God brings into our lives, regardless of their belief system, regardless of their sexual orientation, regardless of their political viewpoint. You see, God made the church to reflect the rich diversity of God's love and the kinds of people that come in, the kinds of people that are in, the kinds of people that come in, and that requires us to be that intentional and aggressive in the way that we reach out. And the reason is, the reason underneath it all is God's faithfulness. All right, last thing I want you to see here is that endurance requires stubborn patience. I think it's verse 24. "The Lord is my portion, says my soul. Therefore, I will hope in him. The Lord is good to those who wait for him, to the soul who seeks him. It is good that one should wait quietly for the salvation of the Lord." For those of you that were here last week, in Psalm 116, we were talking about this a little bit as well. That the fact that God cares about our suffering doesn't necessarily mean he's going to step in and stop the hurt. We need to endure. There is no getting around it. Our character is shaped every time we make the decision to trust God rather than giving into self-pity and saying, "Woe is me. Why me? Why do I have to go through this?" Every time we make the decision to endure and to trust, rather than giving into that spirit, God shapes our character little by little by little. John Calvin put it really plainly. "Most men seek their happiness apart from God." And that's really true, isn't it? "All desire to be happy, but as the thoughts of men wander here and there, there is nothing more difficult than so to fix all of our hopes in God so as to disregard all other things." You know, we have really loud voices in the church, loud and famous and wealthy voices in the church, that are encouraging us to worship God so that he gives us all these other things. And the expectation in the church in America is that hard times are an anomaly. We just need to get through it, because really, God, you know, he wants us to be happy and to be, you know, to have all these good things. And if we have enough faith, things are going to turn around for us. I want you to hear the statement from John Calvin, because it's such a contrast with that message. Couldn't be more stark. Calvin says this: "It is necessary in this world that the faithful should, as to outward things, be miserable." Did you hear that? We are supposed to be miserable. Okay, now understand what he meant. As to outward things. He doesn't mean that you're supposed to be miserable in your attitude. He says you're supposed to experience miserable stuff in life, hard times. That's normal. At one time exposed to want, at another time subject to various dangers, at one time exposed to reproaches, at another time harassed by losses. Why so? Because there would be no occasion for exercising hope were our salvation complete. So you see what he's saying? The fact that God is allowing us to experience this hardship is an expression. It's a part of his salvation. It's a part of him saving us. It's a process, not just a one-time thing. It is a continual process, and the hardship is a part of him saving us. And if it were not there, we would already be in heaven. It'd be done, and it's not. Difficulty is the normal course of events in a sin-cursed world. That's what we're learning about in Veritas in this study on disability. If the Lord is your portion, if you are convinced the way you're convinced that the sun rises in the morning and sets in the evening, or at 4 o'clock in weird places like in New Hampshire, if you're as convinced that the Lord is your portion as that, if you're convinced that you can trust him, then do what the prophet did, who watched this intense suffering. Wait quietly for the salvation of the Lord. Wait until the final point, because salvation is a process. Now, I shared a little bit about the Belgic Confession earlier in the service, and the author of that confession wrote it in hopes that it would be pleasing to Philip II, who was the Roman Catholic ruler of Spain. See, there are a lot of different confessions, the ones that we use, and then there are other ones that we don't use, but they have different emphases. The Westminster Confession really didn't care a hoot about the Catholic Church. They actually went out of their way to be offensive, using words like Antichrist and Popish monastic vows, and there were all kinds of things that they really didn't care, you know, what the Pope thought of what they were doing. As I understand it, the writers of the Belgic Confession were a little bit different. They actually wanted, they were trying to start the Reformation in the Netherlands. They were wanting Philip II to respect them. They didn't expect him to take all of their views. They wanted to appeal to his sense of what is right and what the Bible really teaches. And they tried to be conciliatory without compromising doctrine. Well, it didn't work. Philip II was not, he was not impressed. He didn't agree with him. So the primary writer of the Belgic Confession was a man named Guido de Bray. And modern American culture has done terrible things to the name Guido. So can you try to get beyond that? Whatever image comes first to your mind when you hear the name Guido, would you just erase it right now? Because it's probably from some bad movie. But his name was Guido. So Guido de Bray was imprisoned for his role in writing that confession of faith. And his wife Catherine was brokenhearted when he was arrested. So he wrote this letter to her from prison. He said, "Your grief and anguish troubling me in the midst of my joy and gladness." Now remember, this guy's in prison. "My joy and gladness are the cause of my writing to you this present letter. I most earnestly pray you not to be grieved beyond measure. If the Lord had wished us to live together longer, he could easily have caused it so to be, but such was not his pleasure. Let his good will be done then, and let that suffice for all reason. I pray you then to be comforted in the Lord, to commit yourself and your affairs to him, for he is the husband of the widow and the father of the fatherless, and he will never leave nor forsake you. Goodbye, Catherine, my well-beloved. I pray my God to comfort you and give you resignation to his holy will. Your faithful husband, Guido de Bray." And very shortly, as I understand, after he wrote that letter, he was martyred by hanging. You know, his story was not unusual. In the preface to that confession, the Belgic Confession, the Dutch believers declared they would offer their backs to stripes, their tongues to knives, their mouths to gags, and their whole bodies to the fire, rather than deny the truth of the gospel. And these were not idle words. It's estimated 100,000 believers lost their lives in the process of the Reformation coming to the Netherlands. Now just think about that. 100,000 people. That's just one country. One small area of Europe. 100,000 martyrs. And yet through that tragedy, when God did not step in, and he did not stop the suffering, and he did not stop the martyrdom, when he did not give relief to his children, God was faithful. Do you believe that? Do you believe that God is enough? Are you willing to step out into the unknown, into this year, not knowing what's coming, trusting his will rather than your own? That's the question we have to ask ourselves. Determine, because this is what it requires. It requires a stubborn determination to hold on to that hope no matter what comes. Allow the suffering that he allows into your life to purify you for his glory. It's a much easier thing to say than to do. And if God doesn't bring suffering into your life, guess what he calls you to do? He calls you to come alongside somebody else. So let's ask him for the grace to do that. Let's pray. Dear God in heaven, these are not easy words to read, not easy words to talk about, not easy words to live out. It's not an easy prayer to pray, a thing to ask for. Lord, we don't know what this year holds for us. We don't know what it holds for us as individuals, as families, as a body of believers. But we know that you are faithful. And so I want to ask that you would help us to cling to that truth no matter what happens. And help us to cling to each other and remind each other of your faithfulness and be there for each other. Help us, Lord. Because by nature, we're selfish people. We're looking out for number one. But that's not what you made us to be. And that's not what the gospel is changing us to be. And so help us. And Lord, even now, help us through the sacrament. We thank you for this gift. And we thank you for your precious word. In Christ's name, amen.